Welcome to P&L Group Holding Company, where purpose meets leadership. For more than two decades, we've been at the forefront of advancing inclusive leadership, cultural transformation, and workforce equity across industries. At our core, we believe that inclusion is more than a goal, it's a business imperative. That's why our mission is simple. We help companies align their people, culture, and strategy to drive measurable results and long-term impact. Our work is rooted in research, benchmarking, and a deep understanding of the dynamics shaping today's workforce. We offer executive coaching, talent development, data-driven strategy, and thought leadership platforms that support C-suite leaders, emerging professionals, and organizations ready to lead with intention. Through our flagship brands like Publishing and Multimedia, Diversity Business Review, the Inclusive Leadership Index, and DLS Learning Solutions, we've cultivated a global community that celebrates leadership, champions equity, and ignites real change. Whether you're transforming your organization from within, building your leadership muscle, or looking to measure what matters, we're your partner. P&L Group isn't just a consultancy. We're your ecosystem for inclusive excellence. Join us. Lead forward. Let's redefine what leadership looks like, together.
Saturday morning here in Chicago. I'm Pam McElvain, your host of The Inclusive Voice, WCPT 820 AM. So this morning on the Pulse News, you know, at the Stonewall National Monument in New York City, a large pride flag was quietly removed this week after a directive from the Trump administration. In fact, the Department of the Interior issued guidance stating that only the U.S. flag and other congressional or departmentally authorized flags may fly on the National Park Service property. Sorry, you're hearing that in my voice, but it's a little bit of angst here. Because the Pride flag is considered a non-agency flag, that the National Park Service took it down in compliance with that order. Yet another thing, if you will. But Stonewall is not just any federal site. It marks the birthplace of the modern LGBTQ+IA rights movement, the location of the 1969 uprising that transformed civil rights history. In fact, the Pride flag is not decorative there. It's historically and culturally tied to the movement that emerged from that very ground. So its removal follows other administration actions over the past year, including stripping references to transgender people from the monument's website, revising exhibits at other national parks, and we don't really want to address all the things that happened at the Smithsonian. So over the past year, other changes at national historic sites have included the removal of exhibits, addressing slavery or climate change or immigrant labor. In fact, critics argue this pattern signals more than policy standardization. It's beyond signaling selective storytelling. It's, in my opinion, is actually stripping historical presence of other groups. As you know, historical preservation is not about politics. It should be about truth. We begin stripping away context, language, or symbols that reflect the lived experience of marginalized communities. That's when we risk standing down the complexity of our shared history. Erasure rarely announces itself loudly. Sometimes it looks like a missing word, a dismantled plague, or a flag that no longer flies. Erasure doesn't always mean demolishing a monument. Sometimes it means redefining what is permitted to be remembered. So with that, as we continue to celebrate Black History Month, it's important that we know our heritage is part of our DNA, no matter where it shows up and when it's there. But being steadfast in wanting to remember history and talk about its relevance, that's our right. That's our privilege. So this morning with us, before we go to a commercial break, we're bringing on not only an author, but an incredible healthcare executive, that have been giving back to the community as well as leading large systems and has seen disparities up front, close, and personal. So stay here with me and we bring on our guest, Jamal Miller, Chief Administrative Officer at Dignity Health Mercy Medical Group, a member of Common Spirit Health, the largest nonprofit in the nation. I mean, the largest healthcare system in the nation. So we'll be right back with you after this commercial break.
Breakthroughs aren't just for medical journals. They're to help people hold their grandbabies for the first time. Expertise isn't just for awards or recognition. It can be what gives people the best chance to walk again. At the Frederick and the Medical College of Wisconsin Health Network, people are the driving force behind everything we do. So we never lose sight of what's important, and we never forget who it's for. Because in the end, we're people helping people. That means every breakthrough, every clinical study, every interaction is to help people like you, your family, and your neighbors be the best they can be. We do everything possible because we see everything possible in you. To find out how compassion motivates world-class care, visit Frederick.com.
Okay, welcome back. I'm Pam McElvain, your host of The Inclusive Voice. Oh, I know that was kind of some depressing on the pulse news this morning, but, you know, pull back, grab your coffee, and let's jump right in with our guest, Jamal Miller, calling in and joining us during this celebratory Black History Month. Good morning, Jamal, and how are you?
Good morning. I'm well, Pam. Great to hear your voice.
Yeah. And so where are you calling in from?
I am calling from Northern California, here in Sacramento, California, the state's capital, where I'm born and raised. Glad to be dialing in from sunny California.
Yeah, you know, I don't know what to say about that. He said, but you're up really early to be on our 7 a.m. show. So thank you for joining us and being here. One of the things I do like to ask folks is, you know, in this environment, you know, what do you do to keep yourself both mentally and physically well?
Excellent question. I think we have to be intentional, you know, in moments like this to take control and have the courage to, you know, be responsible for our own health, mental health, and well-being.
But what do you do?
When I think about my personal regimen, which I've done for the last few years, is, you know, I exercise in the morning before I take on the corporate challenges of being a healthcare executive and other responsibilities I have. I get up early in the morning. I spend quiet time in scripture, reading a daily reflection, and I put on my pause app that I have on my phone, and I listen to that while I stretch extensively in preparation for my 3-mile run or my hour-long indoor cycling routine, and I'll lift weights, kind of decompress in the morning, get the day started off, you know, right, you know, and not get caught up in the day-to-day rat race. And what I also do is really monitor my intake of, you know, the toxic information that is out there, and really be, you know, intentional about, you know, filtering in positive, good information and people in my life, because the bad is going to come anyway. So whatever we can do to mitigate and prevent the weathering effect that that can have on our own lives, it makes a huge difference.
Thank you. Now, thank you for that description. That's really good. I guess I could pick up a couple things that I do within that. But what I'm finding that's really consistent, Jamal, is that people are, you know, I start my day with a spiritual regimen and then I go into the physical, is that, you know, there's, you have to start your day with it, or it kind of gets away from you. You really yes. need to reset before you dive into whatever it is, you know, you're going to be facing that day. So I'm finding that to be a best practice. So one of the things that is one, not only your incredible career, but it has, I mean, when did you learn that you wanted to actually go into healthcare? When, and I do want to go back where you went to school and grew up, but I just wanted to ask this question because your career, you know, has stemmed there. So I'm just like, you know, what was that moment that inspired you that I want to be in a field that I'm helping others?
Yes, I always love to respond to this question because it makes me reflective and appreciative of the journey that now exceeds over 27 years working in healthcare. And, you know, early on as a youngster, it was my pediatrician growing up, Dr. Vernon Walton. I was likely single digits when he first made, you know, that indelible impression on me. You know, my family, having roots out of, you know, the Jim Crow South, where, you know, segregated, but yet within our own African-American and Black communities, you had, you know, Black professionals such as dentists, teachers, physicians, so on and so forth. So when our family ultimately landed out here in the 60s, you know, my parents were very intentional about identifying, you know, an African-American physician if there was one that existed in Sacramento. And fortunately, they had a few options, and my parents made the decision that we would have our pediatric care provided by Dr. Vernon Walton, who was very intriguing to me. You know, I learned later that he was one of the first Black pediatricians in the greater Sacramento area. And, you know, my intrigue with him was just, you know, I don't know. It was just, I asked a lot of questions, you know, about him practicing medicine. Where did he go to school? Where was he from? And that was my first introduction, you know, that was beyond just curiosity, where I knew that something having to do with medicine, healthcare, and people would be something that I would find interest in. So years of, you know, going to see him for care and asking questions, coupled with, you know, elementary school, middle school, and high school exposures to other professionals in the field, you know, that's really where the journey accelerated, you know, and inspired me and ultimately fortified, you know, when I got to undergrad, that I wanted to go into healthcare administration more broadly and pivoted from medicine specifically. And the rest is history. When I finished up at Columbia in 98, Columbia University in New York City, and I launched my career in Oakland, California with Kaiser Permanente, and kind of the rest is history. Went to graduate school at USC in Los Angeles, where I got my master's in health administration. But just like the mighty, you know, oak tree started out as an acorn, that acorn of inspiration started with me at a very young age here in Sacramento by Dr. Vernon Walton.
Yeah, what a great story. A great story. I mean, and you talk about, you know, you never know who's going to influence, right, and inspire your lifelong journey. And then you're so humble in sharing with us, you know, and some of the things and where you went to school and study. Where did you go to undergraduate school?
Yes, I applied to 7 schools out of high school, got into 6 of the 7. I won't say the 7 school that denied me. I don't think I was going to go there anyway. But I had the great fortune of getting accepted to Columbia University, 1 of 8 Ivy League schools. And, you know, okay, that was a big trip, going almost 3,000 miles home. But spent 4 years in New York City, graduated from, you know, Columbia with an undergrad degree in psychology, and was definitely eager to get back to the West Coast.
Okay, so now I know how you got out there, because I'm like, okay, how you get out? How you get out there? Okay, you know, and I did it backwards. I stayed in California, went to Berkeley, and then left. Mm-hmm. And see, now it's harder for me to get back.
I hear you.
So that is so incredible. So just so our listening audience know, the reason I really wanted to bring Jamal Miller to the conversation. He's not only a healthcare executive, he's also an author of an incredibly published book. But not only that, you know, he has spent many years working on the administration side in government, public health, not just in corporate and large organizations, but major health systems and the philanthropy side, boards, all of these things that he has done to really look at how we can improve these systems. So this, you know, what I love about your background, Jamal, is you bring this incredibly holistic experience and lens to really help folks understand. So before we are going to talk about your book, but I want to talk about, you know, some of the work you've done. And one of the things that you've been consistent everywhere you've gone is you've led major health equity initiatives, state, local, national, government, private, you know, for-profit, nonprofit, communities, very interfacing in these issues. So can I get you from two perspectives? One, to talk about, you know, from the business perspective, what we have, you know, why healthcare equity initiatives have to continue to stay in the forefront, and then, you know, some of your personal passion and purpose behind you wanting to make sure that there's some impact in this space. Big question.
Yes. Yeah, no problem. You know, we've always come to know the journey towards health and racial equity, you know, obviously within healthcare, but in society more broadly as a moral, social, and ethical imperative. And I will always stand by, you know, that being important. And along the journey, especially over the last 15 or so plus years, the added component of that to make this topic more objectively important to all of us, whether you're a proponent or an opponent of equity, generally speaking, you know, I learned to factor in the importance of equity as a business and an economic imperative and use data to objectively support that and to ultimately tie it to kind of the domestic and economic security of our country, you know, whether we want to embrace that or not. The reality is that we are a browning and tanning country, and we have been for many years. California, as you know, is already a majority state of people of color. When you look at people of color in aggregation in our country as well on the way. So this gets to the future of work. This gets to the future of us being a productive company or country, rather, economically, in commerce, our ability to be stable domestically and internationally. So that being said, great deal of education has to continue to happen for people to understand that there is a significant cost, not just to healthcare systems in general, but really to our economy in the United States of America, significant cost to the tune of trillions of dollars when we factor in the impact that disparities and inequities have in health and mental health. And they disproportionately impact people of color, especially African-American and Black people. But more broadly, when we look at marginalized communities, including, you know, gender categories, sexual orientation, urban versus rural, when we factor in geography across our states, you know, red versus blue states, even when you look at the economic implications of unhealthy people due to disparities, has an adverse impact on our GDP, has an adverse impact on our ability to be productive in industry. And a lot of times when we stay focused on the social, moral, and ethical imperatives of it, which again, they are important, we lose sight of the broader issues. You know, we celebrate capitalism, even if it's conscious capitalism. We celebrate, you know, growing markets and so on and so forth. But the reality is there's a significant cost. And if we flip it, there's a cost savings opportunity if we're intentional about closing gaps associated with inequities and disparities in healthcare. So that messaging for me has become very important. And in my current role, for instance, as the chief administrative officer for Mercy Medical Group, a member of Common Spirit Health, I'm grateful that there is an understanding here within our executive leadership team and our board of directors that equity is a key part of our strategic imperatives, not just as a medical group, but it ties directly back to the broader ministry of Common Spirit Health. I came out of the Office of Diversity, Inclusion, Equity, and Belonging, where I helped spearhead and create Common Spirit's first ever health equity roadmap. And the messaging was the same there. So I'm glad to continue that work. And the economic and business imperative of equity, it's a message that all people need to hear, and I'm hopeful it resonates with the listeners this morning.
Yeah, you know, thank you for that. I really appreciate you sharing. But when you look back, I mean, you've come from, you know, you're an executive at Blue Shield of California, Kaiser Permanente, Sutter Health, Deputy Director of the Office of Health Equity, working state with the, you know, straight with the California Department of Public Health. And so you've had this broad experience, Jamal, but have you, from a collective sense, can you share from a collective sense from these big systems and entities, right? What are we doing to move the issue of the disparities? I mean, are you seeing overall, in spite of what, you know, you're dealing with all the executive orders and what have you, some movement towards, maybe it's not going to be mitigated, but minimized? And if so, you know, what are they? And if not, why not?
Yes, I see, you know, the resistance, these headwinds, which are far more aggressive than we could have ever imagined, but not surprising, you know, when we look at the history of our country. So the extent to which this should not be surprising to us, if we know the impact of structural, systemic, and institutionalized racism, you have to go back into the toolbox of what works, you know, when it comes to healthy resistance. And I think there are major corporate entities in the country, especially in healthcare, that care for thousands and even millions of lives, billion-dollar organizations that have a level of influence that many community-based organizations may not necessarily have. And they are definitely affected by policy and legislation, you know, that has transpired out of this particular administration. But I think the elevated perspective that I take, you know, in my role, and when I think about the organizations that I represent, either as a board member or either as an executive, is that it has been a wonderful time to be reconnected with what's our mission, you know, the fundamentals and the basics of what are we called to as a Common Spirit Health, as a Mercy. I'm on the board of the California Endowment, $4 billion endowment here in the state of California. And, you know, we had our first board meeting last year this time, you know, a few weeks into this administration. And we made an intentional decision to not only be courageous, but to be strategic and to increase to the tune of $200 million additional dollars that we would be willing to spend to invest, you know, in the infrastructure of our community-based organizations and grantees across the state of California who are doing the important work to address disparities, to strengthen communities, to build power. And I've seen this, you know, as a moment, of course, of reckoning, of hardship, a reality check. It's been very sobering, but it's also been a wonderful opportunity to just see, you know, ministries like Common Spirit, organizations like the California Endowment, and many others who have withstood the challenging times we're in and decided to be courageous, to stay committed to mission, and to invest the resources, both financial, human, and in kind, to continue doing this important work. And not just doing it out of passion or emotion, but doing it by by supporting it with the data and analytics of the realities of what's going on in our country. It's undeniable the public health challenges we're having. It's undeniable that you have communities that are disproportionately impacted by certain diseases. It's undeniable the plight, you know, that we see around homelessness and things of that nature, public safety issues. So those issues can't be, you know, we can't turn a blinded eye to them. We can't make them political. We have to objectively and responsibly address those issues. And I'm grateful, you know, that I've been affiliated with organizations that double down on that commitment, are strategic, you know, and understanding that you have to work with and or navigate through the challenges of such administrations. But the communities have needs, and, you know, private and public organizations have to respond to those needs in a collaborative, authentic way. And that's what inspires and motivates me where I am in my life and my career.
Yeah, you know, thank you for that. I really like where you said, you know, hey, we decided to be courageous and strategic, you know, regardless of it all. So that's a big, you know, for folks out there, you know, those are some big words and to put, and then you talked about, hey, we'll put our money where our mouth is by continuing this level of investment. So we're going to take a quick commercial break, but when we come back, Jamal, I'm going to dive a little bit more into, you know, looking at the responsibility of the big systems. Is this something you're doing out of good faith, or is this something that you feel you're responsible? So I want to lean a little bit more on that courageous and strategic question as you have to continue to be profitable. So stay with us for this incredible conversation with this incredible leader. We'll be right back with you after this commercial break.
Life changing is what drives us, all of us. At UPMC, we believe life-changing medicine can't wait, and that our breakthroughs are only as good as the people they help. Serving more than just patients and members, but whole communities, to change the future of health for everyone. Because only then can we call it life-changing medicine. UPMC.
Welcome back. I'm your host, Pam McElvain, with our guest, Chief Administrative Officer William Jamal Miller. He's actually out of California, but with a large system, Common Spirit, but he heads the Dignity Health Mercy Medical Group. It's a nationally recognized system as well. And what he is representing too is, you know, what are the large health systems doing? I mean, you see the Kaiser Permanentes, you see the networks of the, you know, the insurance big systems, Blue Cross Blue Shields around the nation, and all these other systems, you know, Common Spirit, Dignity Health. What are they doing? So we have here with us, you know, one of these executives that not just has a personal commitment, but is talking about what their organization, the system is doing around equity initiatives. He's throwing some numbers behind it too. So that's really important because, Jamal, as you talk about, Mercy Medical Group generates over $270 million in annual revenue. And you have to balance, you know, financial stewardship, deliver high quality patient-centered care, but also, you know, be very cautious of what's happening, you know, with the spillover from the community into your workforce or your workplace, and making sure you guys balance all of that. So talk to us a little bit of how, you know, your strategic and courageous commitments and execution and delivery, how you're navigating that.
Yeah, we, you know, Mercy Medical Group obviously is on the physician enterprise side of Common Spirit Health. We have just under 600 physicians and advanced practice providers in our group. We've been around for over 75 years, and I have the, you know, opportunity to work daily with just a number of physician leaders and physician practitioners who are just serving the greater community of Sacramento very, very well across a multi-specialty vertical platform of care. And our CEO of the group, Dr. Alan Chatzel, who by practice is a neurologist, just a very humble but yet strong and insightful leader that brought me on a few years ago to be the chief administrative officer. And collaboratively, it has been a wonderful journey to, you know, build a strong executive leadership team structure and to be intentional with our board of directors about becoming a group that is reflective of the community that we serve. And what I mean by that is doing the best that we can to recruit and retain a talent by way of demographics, when we think about race, ethnicity, gender, when we think of the importance of providing culturally competent and congruent care. And even though, you know, we still have a great ways to go, and it's not unique to Mercy Medical Group, we know that there are not just physician shortages across the country, but when you break it out by race, ethnicity, and gender, it's even far more challenging for communities of color, and the pipeline needs to be stimulated. But yet, we're still very intentional about outreach and developing our physicians and other providers to make sure that we're able to serve a very diverse community. And when we look at the numbers, you know, not just the financial performance of the group and, you know, significant revenue generated by physicians and the care that they provide, but most of all, the quality outcomes, the value outcomes, our managed care, capitated lives that we have responsibility for. When we look at the provider experience numbers, when we look at the patient experience numbers, when you look objectively at the key performance indicators for our group by industry standards and even within Common Spirit, as a, you know, with the largest non-academic medical group in Common Spirit, we're performing well. And we're also mindful of opportunity areas where we can do even better. And a big part of our ability to do better is how deeply we are connected to community, to hear community voices, to get feedback from patients and colleagues, you know, in the care centers where care is provided, in hospitals, in the ambulatory outpatient setting, and virtually, how we engage with patients and families, as well as home-based care that is provided. So that's, you know, how dynamic the experience is between our medical group, you know, our hospitals and the communities that we serve. And we're grateful, you know, that two areas in particular make us different as a healthcare system. On one hand, you know, it's the mission as a nonprofit, you know, healthcare delivery system that Mercy Medical Group is a part of. But the other part is like the elevated higher calling, you know, being a religious affiliated or being a Catholic healthcare system, to where the quote unquote least of these, when we think about the vulnerable and the poor, marginalized communities, the immigrant, yeah, the widow, there's a rich, rich history there that is inseparable from who we are as a healthcare ministry. And that's the beauty of having that coverage, you know, in this time, that really drives and motivates what we do specifically as Mercy Medical Group.
You know, I like that, you know, the way you talked about and tied in the community deeply, because, you know, And with everything that's going on, and you also talked about all groups, and what people don't realize is that, you know, the healthcare is one of the industries that has to stay relevant to the differences and the very uniqueness of people just based on the populations you serve. You know, so folks don't think about that's like core part of your business in what you have to do. But when you've spoken, you know, publicly about the cost of racism. In fact, you know, to be honest, you really, you know, kind of stepped back and said, let me write a book and go a little deeper and help you guys understand, you know, what I'm talking about. And, you know, what does racism cost our healthcare system? I mean, first I have to go back and ask you, you know, what inspired you to really talk about it in a racism in a quantifiable way, that you said, let me go ahead and put pen to paper on this?
Yes, I'm a big, you know, I started out my career as a consulting data analyst. That was my title in state and government programs, part of Kaiser Permanente. And, you know, that has stayed with me. The analyst in me always appreciates the value of good data and using data and analytics to really drive your decisions. I know everything can't be as mechanical or, you know, as technical, but sometimes you have to feel, you know, and show compassion and empathy. All of that stuff is extremely important to me, and that's a part of who I am. When it comes to business practice and also engaging unusual suspects, often those who are in opposition to what we stand for when it comes to equity matters. So it's like, okay, know your audience and use the language that they understand. So when opponents, you know, to the work talk about how important the economy is, or they talk about how important, you know, productivity is, or how important voting is, you know, when it comes to being civically engaged and politically incorporated, then I have the ability and the latitude to like shift and say, okay, let me speak that language. Let me be multilingual to meet you where you are and to help you understand. And particularly in business, you know, in commerce, it's let me help the CEO of a company understand that the more disparities that exist within your commercially insured workforce, you know, that's going to drive up your cost of healthcare, and it's also going to adversely impact your ability to be productive as a company. Or let me, you know, talk to you from a risk management governance standpoint, that if you're on the board of directors for a publicly traded entity, and, you know, the understanding the audience, you know, you talk about the importance of business in the economic case. And again, I learned, you know, that the power of analytics and data is extremely important to drive key decisions. But specifically for people who are antagonists, who are opponents, you know, I listen to what matters to them most. And when people are talking about the importance of economics, growth, productivity, being politically engaged, so on and so forth, then I pivot and talk about the numbers, you know, from that vantage point to help engage them differently. You know, you may not flip someone's understanding and interest when it comes to equity and addressing, you know, issues of disparities, or more broadly helping them understanding how much of a drag on society racism and discrimination is, but you can help, you know, enlighten them. And maybe along the way, if they're sincerely open and objective on issues like this, and they want to be converted, then they might hear you differently. But when people hear, you know, that it can cost your company millions of dollars and the country hundreds of millions or billions or even trillions of dollars, then that creates a pathway, a way of entry to have a different conversation and let people know that we are all paying the price, not just the folks that you think you're harming by way of explicit racism and discrimination. But we all pay the price, including,
you know, Jamal, you know, but let me just jump in for a second, because, you know, you're talking, you know, macro and stuff, but that individual person, you know, they don't get it directly sometimes.
Yeah.
In terms of how that relates to them. So if you could kind of, you know, make that connection for that individual person when you're talking, yeah, this is with the large systems on the business side and the overall issues, but how does that, you know, drill down to me as a person, regardless of what they don't understand, disparities and inequity is colorblind. So,
yeah.
You know, we're talking disproportionate numbers. So regardless of where you are. So if you don't mind just kind of giving an example, I mean, you're giving a master class here, so I wanted to pull you back in, you know, for our day-to-day folks to kind of understand. So how does that relate to me, kind of thing?
Yes. Okay. I think about Dr. King's statement about how we're all inextricably linked, you know, and there is something I've struggled with of late, is that there's a very individualistic, very kind of selfish approach to how we navigate, you know, through these current times, this me, myself, and I, and not understanding that we weren't meant to live hermetical lives, but my success or not is very much tied to that of a Pam McElvain or my neighbor, so on and so forth. So the example that I use personally is that at any given time, you know, any of us can be quote unquote vulnerable. You know, vulnerability, first of all, I believe there's strength in vulnerability. But when I mean, you know, when I talk about being vulnerable or vulnerable populations, in most people, our bias defaults to thinking about a certain type of person who is vulnerable. You know, we it just whatever it is, you know, if you're listening to this morning, think about, you know, a vulnerable person and challenge yourself to think about someone beyond that defaulted profile of a person that comes into your mind. And what I mean by that is that at any given time, someone could lose their job. At any given time, someone could become insecure financially. At any given time, your nephew or your niece can announce that they are LGBTQ. At any given time, you can lose your commercial insurance and have to pivot to have a publicly provided government subsidized healthcare product such as Medicaid. At any given time, you know, an infectious disease can affect an entire country or community. And now we realize how interconnected we are. A natural disaster can hit our community, whether it's a major snowstorm or flood or an earthquake, or we have an attack, you know, on our community or our country by foreign entity. So when I say that any of us at any time can be vulnerable, it strikes a chord of empathy and why compassion is so important. And that's where I bring it to the footstep, you know, of everyone. People who say like, hey, I've got it all together, and that equity business is only for those folks across town. But at any given time, the fact that any of us could be vulnerable and you're stricken, you know, with a disease and you get a diagnosis that you did not expect, now you're dependent on a healthcare system where you need access, you know, and then you start to experience obstacles and barriers being a part of a very challenging healthcare system that needs to be navigated through. So those are the illustrations, kind of the hypothetical.
Yeah.
And I get in response to that any of us is raising our hand at any given time on the definition of who a vulnerable person is. And I think that's really important for people to understand.
Thank you for that. I think you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right in terms of, you know, having the true clarity on that. And I appreciate it very, very much. So in terms of, you know, here we are, you know, when we're almost at the end of the hour, which is crazy. you know, recognition of Black History Month. Thank you for your reference to Dr. Martin Luther King, because isn't that amazing how he's still right today,
yes.
You know, many decades later. So in recognition, you know, how do you reflect on the legacy of Black physicians and healthcare advocates in terms of shaping, you know, the work we have to do ahead, the future work?
Yeah, I reflect with gratitude. You know, I'm a non-clinical, non-physician executive, but it's been physicians throughout the course of my professional life that have inspired me and motivated me in so many different ways. But as we started at the top of the show, Vernon Walton, you know, literally is a Black physician who inspired me directly. And when we look at the generation of physicians who are coming up out of the ranks of Black physicians, we're still in the relatively early generations of, you know, a society where it was okay for us to even advance our studies to ultimately become physicians, and the phenomenal progress that has been made, but yet we still have a long way to go. But I can't you know, have a Black history moment, and or we don't have African-American history or American history without acknowledging the likes of Richard Allen Williams, for instance, a groundbreaking, trailblazing cardiologist who was a founder of the Association of Black Cardiologists. Dr. Williams, who used to be the cardiologist for Miles Davis, is one of the first, or the first African-American out of the state of Delaware to go to the School of Medicine at Harvard. He's 89 years old, lives in Southern California. He's a mentor and a friend. And the Association of Black Cardiologists over the years has generated hundreds of cardiologists across the country. And we attribute that to the likes of a Richard Allen Williams. We think of, you know, Michael Lenores, Dr. Michael Lenores of the world out of Oakland, California, past president for the National Medical Association. The National Medical Association has a rich, rich legacy of impact around the world and came into existence. Why? Because there was a time where the American Medical Association did not allow Black and African-American physicians membership. So I've had mentors out of these organizations that have directly inspired me as a professional, but most of all personally, to be courageous, to be persistent, to be resilient. And in moments like this, you know, like I said, we've seen obstacles like we're facing today before, and we find our motivation and inspiration by paying homage, you know, acknowledging not just trailblazers of history, but those who are currently making a difference in this 21st century in 2026. And we have to be intentional about lifting them up, celebrating them, and not allowing anyone to erase our contributions, our history, our documentation. But we unashamedly lift up and celebrate the accomplishments out of our community.
Thank you for that. That was like, woo, I couldn't even keep track of them. I said, and I guess that's that work you do. You get to have the pulse on these great physicians that's doing the work, right? They're just not, you know, these smart people that have learned this craft, but they truly are giving back and making impact and a significant difference. I really could talk to you for a long time, but I'm sure folks can go to Amazon, right, and get your book. If you just, yes. You know, I think it's a good just, you know, to have in the shelf on the cost of racism in the healthcare system. And the other good thing is, you know, here's a book that's backed with information, and particularly for, you know, for our men and our young boys, being able to understand, you know, some of the impact and why it's so important, you know, to be healthy and go do preventive stuff. That's another conversation to talk about.
For sure.
The prevention side of medical. But so Jamal, as we end up, and you know, folks, again, Jamal Miller is the Chief Administrative Officer at Dignity Health Mercy Medical Group, which is a member of the Common Spirit Health. And you can go to, you know, look them up on Google, LinkedIn, the website, if you want to learn more about the work that Dignity Health and more specifically Jamal Miller is doing. What last advice, what nugget would you give our audience in hearing and learning all this information that you just shared with us, which I appreciate so much, in really bridging the gap? You really gave us enough information to help bridge the gap of understanding of what large systems are doing, what doctors are doing, what the mission is, what the commitment can be and should be, you know, and the government entities. You really shared a lot in this past hour. So, but what would be advice, a little bit of nuggets you would leave for our individual listeners?
Yes, to use a term that has, you know, been made out to be negative, which I still think is very positive. Stay woke, you know, stay woke by being informed, you know, being educated. You know, there's a movement in this country that is exploiting ignorance. I think especially in our community, we cannot afford, you know, that exploitation. So be informed, be educated, And tell your story. That's one of the reasons why I wrote my book, Equity, Equality, and Justice for All, Born to Be an Advocate, which you can find on JamalMiller.com or Amazon or Barnes & Noble. And that part of my motivation was to tell my story. You know, no one can tell it like I can. And it's a memoir that taps into my professional career, yes, but most of all, my personal journey of who inspired me, what inspired me. And that's the importance of contributing, you know, to literature, to document, to tell our story. And like you said, Pam, to bridge the gap, you know, from ignorance to enlightenment, and to inspire and motivate others as to what's possible, and to also pay homage and let those know who have inspired you that they did inspire you. Celebrate them, lift them up, and tell your story. So just let's stay woke. You know, we make the culture doesn't make us, and our influence domestically and internationally as a people is incomparable. So use our words, use our language, use our culture to affect change positively.
Ooh, thank you. And with that, please, please, at Jamal Miller, that's JAHMALMILLER.com. Get your book, Equity, Equality, and Justice. And as I stated, it helps you get to, you know, what the healthcare systems are doing and the personal memoir on why it's important to everyone, not just some, but everyone. Thank you all again for listening to our show. Once again, we'll be back next week, and we do have a treat. We have a town hall that we will share with you next week, how to sign up with Martin Luther King III, the author of The Legacy, his book. He will be doing a live town hall for us in celebration of Black History Month. So we will be giving out the first 50 complimentary seats next week. So we look forward to coming back and joining you. And I'm out, Pam McElvin, your host of The Inclusive Voice.
Don't let the tight labor market get in the way of your company's success. Open your mind to new ideas and open your enterprise to new workforce solutions. With Bold Business, companies can leverage extensive global assets and a lengthy track record of success in reducing labor costs. Don't let borders get in the way of giving your company the best possible workforce. For remote positions, Bold Business can save clients up to 30 to 50% with skilled and experienced candidates from a global talent pool. Head to boldbusiness.com for more information.
Imagine being part of a network where your voice matters, your leadership is nurtured, and your growth is intentional. That's what our membership community offers. When you join us, you're not just gaining access, you're stepping into a movement. Our membership platform connects executive leaders, emerging talent, and inclusion champions who are committed to personal, professional, and organizational transformation. With your membership, you'll receive exclusive access to benchmarking insights, learning labs, virtual masterminds, curated networking, and mentoring circles. We offer tiered access from professionals looking to advance their careers to executives ready to influence at scale. You'll also get preferred rates to our national conference, regional receptions, and VIT talks. Plus, speaking and publishing opportunities to elevate your brand and thought leadership. What makes us different? We don't just celebrate leaders, we build them. This isn't a subscription. It's a strategic investment in your legacy. So whether you're here to grow, connect, or lead, your next level starts with us. Join the community. Move forward. And make equity real together.